Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America in Washington. Today is Memorial Day, a time to remember and honor those who died in service to the nation. Hundreds of thousands of patriots are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. We will tell you about those hallowed grounds today. Then you will hear Jonathan Evans' weekly technology report. This week, he tells us how smartphones are being used to warn about earthquakes. And as always, we bring you our regular weekday series, The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about the very strong relationship between President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and how that relationship may have affected World War II.
Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years.
And finally, in our American Moments series, we take you back to May 25th, 1961, the day President John F. Kennedy asked Congress to approve his plan to land an American on the moon before 1970.
No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space.
As you can tell, we've got quite a show for you today. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. It is Memorial Day here in the United States. The holiday used to be celebrated on May 30th. But since 1971, Memorial Day has been observed on the last Monday in May, whether or not it falls on the 30th, so that many Americans can have a 3-day holiday weekend. It has become the traditional beginning of the summer travel and vacation season. The main federal government observance of Memorial Day is held at Arlington National Cemetery, across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. The president, or his representative, places a wreath of flowers at the Tomb of the Unknowns, honoring all of the men and women who have died in America's wars. More than 4 million people visit the cemetery every year. It is the most famous national burial place in the United States. It includes about 250 hectares of rolling hills and trees that were planted hundreds of years ago. Up and down the hills are lines of simple white headstones marking the graves. About 400 of the markers have gold letters on them. These are the burial places of those who have been awarded the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest military honor. Among those buried at the cemetery are military and political leaders, cabinet officers, and Supreme Court justices. Astronauts, explorers, and athletes are also buried there. So are chaplains, nurses, slaves, and even war correspondents. Arlington is on the land that once belonged to George Washington Parke Custis, a step-grandson of George Washington. The cemetery holds the graves of soldiers who died in every war in American history. Some who fought and died in the Revolutionary War in the 1700s were moved there from a nearby cemetery. The first military burial was on May 13, 1864, for Private William Christman, who died in the Civil War. On May 15, 1864, two unknown Union soldiers were buried at Arlington. They were the first of almost 5,000 unknowns who are now buried at the cemetery. On March 4, 1921, Congress approved the burial of an unidentified American soldier from World War I. It is now the site of the famed Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Nearly 4,000 former slaves are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. One of them is James Parks. He dug the first graves in the cemetery, and he is the only person buried there who was also born on the property. Two American presidents are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. William Howard Taft was president in the early 1900s. John F. Kennedy was president in the 1960s. More people have visited his grave than any other in the United States. Other famous people buried at the cemetery include Joe Louis. He was an Army sergeant in World War II. He was a world champion boxer. Robert E. Perry discovered the North Pole. Dr. Anita Newcomb McGee founded the Army Nurse Corps. And the remains of the seven astronauts, who died when the space shuttle Challenger exploded, are buried in Section 46. 65 foreigners are also buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Britain has the most, with 26. South Vietnam has 10, including 9 unknown soldiers. Not everyone who gave military service to the United States may be buried at the cemetery. Those who can be buried there include anyone who died while serving on active duty or who retired from the military. Also eligible are those who received high military awards, including the Medal of Honor, those who were injured in combat, and former prisoners of war. Some federal government officials and the spouse and children of those buried at Arlington may also be eligible. There is no cost for the burial or funeral service. Cemetery officials are worried that they will soon run out of space, so they have added an area where the ashes of people who chose to be cremated rather than buried can be placed. There are tens of thousands of spaces in the building, which is called a columbarium. The cemetery is also expanding by almost 11 hectares. This will add almost 30,000 burial places. Since 1948, on the Thursday before Memorial Day, soldiers from the 3rd U.S. Infantry, the Old Guard, have placed small American flags in front of every headstone in the cemetery. This year, more than 1,000 Old Guard soldiers placed more than 220,000 flags in front of each grave marker to honor every individual buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Some of the Old Guard soldiers placed flags in front of the graves of soldiers they knew in Section 60. Some have called it the saddest place in America. It is where some of the soldiers who died in America's latest wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are buried. Now, it's time for our weekly look at the latest technology news. Scientists have now added earthquake detector to the long list of possible uses for mobile phones. Researchers say gathering data from many phones or crowdsourcing could provide early warning when an earthquake strikes. Crowdsourcing uses information from the public to contribute to a project. Now, Jonathan Evans tells us how smartphones are being used to help tell when an earthquake is about to hit.
Countries where earthquakes take place, like the United States and Japan, have very exact earthquake measuring devices. But Ben Brooks says the measuring equipment is costly. He is a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey. He says many parts of the world do not have the resources for such devices. Mr. Brooks told VOA by Skype that an increasing number of people around the world carry smartphones with GPS navigation. GPS is a radio system that uses signals from satellites to tell where you are and gives directions to other places. Michael Bevis is a geophysicist at The Ohio State University. He says that the GPS on smartphones is not as accurate as the GPS scientists use. However, he says what the measurements lack in accuracy, they make up for in numbers. Crowdsourcing could confirm that an earthquake really was happening. One shaking phone would not set off alarms. That could just be someone jumping on a bus, Brooks said. Brooks and colleagues simulated a magnitude 7 earthquake near San Francisco. They found that with less than 5,000 phones feeding into the network, they could detect the earthquake 5 seconds after it started. That would give enough time to warn people to take cover before the most damaging waves from the earthquake arrived. Mr. Brooks's group did not get its results with regular wireless phones, however. The researchers changed how the phones process information to compensate for the movement as one walks down the street. With the phones that are available right now off the shelf, it would only be the largest earthquakes that would be detectable, the magnitude 8s and above, he said. A minor software change could fix that issue, he says, if phone makers wanted to do so. Built-in GPS systems also keep getting better. Michael Bevis says there is another factor to consider. He was in Chile in 2010 following a magnitude 8.8 earthquake. He says the mobile phone system was one of the first to collapse. But he says that the idea is still a good one, especially in places with no other choices. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. Now it's time for our daily The Making of a Nation program. History is full of examples of leaders joining to meet common goals. But rarely have two leaders worked together with as much friendship and cooperation as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill did. Roosevelt was President of the United States. Churchill was Prime Minister of Britain. The two men had much in common. They were both born to wealthy families, and they were both active in politics for many years. Both leaders also shared a love of history, nature, and the sea. Roosevelt and Churchill first met when they were lower-level officials during World War I. But neither man remembered much about that meeting. However, as they worked together during the Second World War, they came to like and trust each other. Steve Ember picks up the story from there.
Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged more than 1,700 letters and messages over a period of 5.5 years. They met many times at large international gatherings and in private talks. But the closeness of their friendship might be seen best in a story told by one of Roosevelt's close advisors, Harry Hopkins. Hopkins remembered how Churchill was visiting Roosevelt at the White House one day. Roosevelt went into Churchill's room in the morning to say hello, but the president was shocked to see Churchill coming from the bathroom with no clothes on. Roosevelt immediately apologized to the British leader, but Churchill reportedly answered, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." The United States and Great Britain were the most powerful of the nations that joined together as allies to resist Germany's Adolf Hitler and his Axis partners. In January of 1942, 26 of the Allied nations signed an agreement promising to fight for the goals of peace, religious freedom, human rights, and justice. The three major allies were the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. The governments in Washington and London did not always agree. For example, they disagreed about when to attack Hitler's forces in Western Europe. And Churchill resisted Roosevelt's suggestions that Britain give up some of its colonies. But in general, the friendship between Roosevelt and Churchill, and between the United States and Britain, led the two nations to cooperate closely. This was not true with the Soviets. The Soviet Union was a communist country. It did not share the same history or political system as the United States or Britain. And the Soviet Union had its own interests to protect along its borders and in other areas. Relations between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies were mixed. On the one hand, Hitler's invasion deep into the Soviet Union had forced Joseph Stalin and other Soviet leaders to make victory over the Germans their most important goal. On the other hand, shadows of future problems could already be seen. The Soviet Union was making clear its desire to keep political control over Poland, and it was supporting communist fighters in Yugoslavia and Greece. These differences were not discussed much as the foreign ministers of Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States gathered in Moscow in 1943. Instead, they reached several agreements, including on a plan to establish a new organization called the United Nations. Finally, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin met together for the first time. They met in Tehran in late 1943, mainly to discuss the military situation. However, the three leaders also considered political questions, such as the future of Germany, Eastern Europe, and East Asia. Later, the Allies made further plans for the new United Nations. They arranged for new international economic organizations, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And the Allies agreed to divide Germany into different parts after the war for a temporary period. The Soviet Union would occupy the eastern part, while Britain, France, and the United States would occupy the west. Washington, London, and Moscow were united during the early years of the war because of military need. They knew they must fight together to defeat their common enemy. But this unity faded as Allied troops marched toward the German border. Roosevelt continued to call on the world to wait until the last bullet was fired before deciding what would come next. But Churchill, Stalin, and other leaders already were trying to shape the world that would follow the war. Now differences between the Allies became more serious. The most important question was Poland. Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939 had started the war. Roosevelt and Churchill believed strongly that the Polish people should have the right to choose their own leaders after the war. Churchill supported a group of Polish resistance leaders who had an office in London. In 1940, Polish flyers had taken part in the Battle of Britain, piloting British warplanes against the German Luftwaffe. But Stalin had other ideas. He demanded that Poland's border be changed to give more land to the Soviet Union, and he refused to help the Polish resistance leaders in London. Instead, he supported a group of Polish communists and helped them establish a new government in Poland. Churchill visited Stalin late in 1944. The two leaders met with Roosevelt a few months later in Yalta on the Crimean coast. All agreed that free elections should be held quickly in Poland, and they traded ideas about the future of Eastern Europe, China, and other areas of the world. Roosevelt was in good spirits when he reported to Congress after his return from the Yalta conference.
I come from the Crimea conference with a firm belief that we have made a good start on the road to a world of peace. There were two main purposes in this Crimea conference. The first was to bring defeat to Germany with the greatest possible speed and the smallest possible loss of Allied men. That purpose is now being carried out in great force. The German army and the German people are feeling the ever-increasing might of our fighting men and of the Allied armies, and every hour gives us added pride in the heroic advance of our troops in Germany, on German soil, toward a meeting with the gallant Red Army. The second purpose was to continue to build the foundation for an international accord that would bring order and security after the chaos of the war. It would give some assurance of lasting peace among nations of the world. That goal, too, in that goal, toward that goal, a tremendous stride was made.
Roosevelt went on to say that the peace cannot be a completely perfect system at first, but it can be a peace based on the idea of freedom. Churchill had the same high hopes. He told the British Parliament after the conference that Stalin and other Soviet leaders wish to live in honorable friendship. I also know that their word is honest, Churchill said. But as history proved, Roosevelt and Churchill were wrong about the Soviets. In the months after the Yalta Conference, relations between Moscow and the Western democracies grew steadily worse. The Soviet Union moved to seize control of Eastern Europe. Stalin began making strong speeches, charging that Washington and London were holding secret peace negotiations with Germany. And the Soviet Union refused to discuss ways to bring democracy to Poland. Churchill wrote later that he had always held the Russian people in high honor, but their shadow darkened the picture after the war. Britain and America had gone to war not just to defend the smaller countries, but also to fight for individual rights and freedoms. Churchill went on to say that the Soviet Union had other goals. Its hold tightened on Eastern Europe after the Soviet army gained control. And Churchill said that after the long suffering and efforts of World War II, it seemed that half of Europe had just exchanged one dictator for another. Churchill and Roosevelt agreed in secret letters that they must try to oppose the Soviet effort. But before they could act, Roosevelt died. And the world began to live through a new war, the Cold War, in the years to follow. Roosevelt's death, from bleeding in the brain, also ended a deep personal friendship between two world leaders. Winston Churchill later wrote about hearing the news of the death of his close friend. "I felt as if I had been struck with a physical blow," Churchill wrote. He said he was overpowered by a sense of deep and permanent loss.
Thanks, Steve. The free world joined Churchill in mourning the loss of so strong a leader as Franklin Roosevelt. But it could not weep for long. War was giving way to peace. A new world was forming. And as we will hear tomorrow on The Making of a Nation, it was a world that few people expected. Now, an American moment. It was on this day, May 25th, 1961, that President John F. Kennedy asked Congress to support his plan to land an American on the moon before 1970. President Kennedy said the project would strengthen defense efforts of the United States, build the nation's economy, and improve the image of the United States around the world.
"I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. But in a very real sense, it will not be one man going to the moon. It will be an entire nation."
President Kennedy's challenge was met 8 years later, on July 20th, 1969. On that day, Apollo 11 astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin landed on the moon. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English and some of the history of the United States. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from The Voice of America.